Denny bristled. By the child, you mean my daughter, Zoe.
Yes, the man said, sizing up Denny. I mean your daughter, Zoe.
This is Washington State, for Christ's sake. Unless you're cooking meth in your kitchen, the child is always awarded to the biological parent, no question.
Okay, Denny said. Don't panic, don't get mad, be polite. Call them and give them my information. Tell them all correspondence has to be directed to me as your attorney. I'll call their lawyers and let them know the big dog is in your corner. My feeling is they're looking for a soft spot. They're hoping you'll go away quietly. Grandparents are like that. Grandparents are convinced they're better parents than their own kids whose lives they've already fucked up. The problem is, grandparents are pains in the ass because they have money. Do they have money?
Plenty.
And you?
Oil changes for life, Denny said with a forced smile.
Oil changes ain't going to cut it, Dennis. My rate is $4.50 an hour. I need a $2,500 retainer. Do you have it?
I'll get it, Denny said.
When? Today? This week? Next week?
Denny looked at him hard. This is my daughter, Mark. I promise on my soul you'll get every dollar you have coming to you. She's my daughter. Her name is Zoe. And I would appreciate it if you would use her name, or at least a gender-correct pronoun, when you refer to her.
Mark sucked in his cheeks and nodded. I totally understand, Dennis. She's your daughter, and her name is Zoe, and I understand that you're a friend, and I trust you. I apologize for even questioning. Sometimes I get people... He paused.
Me to you, Dennis? We're talking about $7,000 or $8,000 to make this thing go away.
You can do that, right?
Of course you can.
I waive my retainer for you, my friend.
He stood up, and the chair almost stood with him, but he shucked himself out of it before it embarrassed him in front of the Victrola crowd.
This is a totally bogus custody suit. I can't even imagine why they would bother to file it.
Call the in-laws, your in-laws, and tell them everything goes through me. I'll have the paralegal on this today. My paralegal.
I really have a problem with my pronouns, don't I? Thanks for pointing it out.
Trust me. They didn't see this coming. They're playing you for a sucker, and you aren't a sucker, are you, champ?
He cuffed Denny on the chin.
Be cool with them, Mark said. Don't get angry. Be cool. And everything is in little Zoe's best interest. Got it? Always say everything is for her. Got it?
Got it, Denny said.
The man paused solemnly.
How are you holding up, friend?
I'm fine, Denny said.
Taking time off? A head-clearing walk with, what's his name?
Enzo.
Good name. Good-looking dog.
He's upset, Denny said. I'm taking him to work with me today. I don't feel comfortable leaving him home, alone.
Maybe you should take some time off, Mark said. Your wife just passed away. Plus, this nonsense?
Craig will give you some time off, and if he doesn't, I'll call him and rattle his cage with the threat of a workplace harassment suit.
Thanks, Mark, Denny said. But I can't stay home right now. It reminds me too much.
I need to work. I need to do something. Keep moving.
Understood, Mark said. Say no more.
He gathered his bag.
I have to admit, he said, watching you win that race on TV was pretty sweet. Where was that?
Last year.
Watkins Glen, Denny said. Yeah, Watkins Glen. That was sweet. The wife had some people over, and I was barbecuing, and I turned on the little TV in the kitchen, and the guys were watching...
Sweet.
Denny smiled, but it was without conviction.
You're a good man, Dennis, Mark said. I'll take care of this. Of all the things you have to worry about, this is not one of them. You let me worry about this part. You take care of your daughter, okay?
Thanks. Mark trundled off down the street, and when he had rounded the corner, Denny looked at me and held his hands out in front of himself. They were shaking. He didn't say anything. But he looked at his hands trembling, and then he looked at me, and I knew what he was thinking. He was thinking that if he just had a steering wheel to hold on to, his hands wouldn't shake. If he had a steering wheel to hold on to, everything would be all right.
32.
I spent most of the day hanging out in the garage with the guys who fixed the cars because the owners of the shop didn't like it when I was in the lobby where the customers could see me. I knew all the guys in the garage. I didn't go to work very often, but I'd been there enough that they all knew me and gave me a hard time by doing things like throwing wrenches across the shop and trying to get me to fetch them. And when I refused, they'd laugh and comment on how smart I was. There was one tech guy in particular, Fenn, who was really nice. And every time he walked by me, he would ask, "Are you done yet?" At first, I had no idea what he was talking about, but I finally figured out that one of the shop's owners, Craig, spent most of his time asking if the techs were finished with their cars, and Fenn was just passing it on down the line to the only one who ranked below him, me. "Are you done yet?" I felt strangely anxious that day, in a very human way. People are always worried about what's happening next. They often find it difficult to stand still, to occupy the now, without worrying about the future. People are not generally satisfied with what they have. They are very concerned with what they are going to have. A dog can almost power down his psyche and slow his anticipatory metabolism, like David Blaine attempting to set the record for holding his breath at the bottom of a swimming pool. The tempo of the world around him simply changes. On a normal dog day, I can sit still for hours on end with no effort. But that day, I was anxious. I was nervous and worried, uneasy and distracted. I paced around and never felt settled. I didn't care for the sensation, yet I realized it was possibly a natural progression of my evolving soul, and therefore I tried my best to embrace it. One of the garage bays was open, and a sticky drizzle fogged the air. Skip, the big funny man with the long beard, dutifully washed the cars that were ready for pickup, even though it was raining. "Rain isn't dirty. Dirt is dirty," he repeated to himself, a Seattle car-washing mantra. He squeezed his clump of sponge, and soapy water rushed like a river down the windshield of an immaculately cared-for British racing green BMW 2002. I lay, head between my forelegs, just inside the threshold of the garage, watching him work. The day seemed like it would never end, until the Seattle police car showed up, and two policemen got out. "Can't offer you gentlemen a wash," Skip called to them. The men seemed confused by the question. They exchanged a glance. "It's raining," one of them said. "Rain isn't dirty," Skip said cheerfully. "Dirt is dirty." The policemen looked at him strangely, as if they didn't know if he was mocking them. "No, thanks," one of them said, as they walked to the lobby door and went inside. I nosed through the swinging door in the garage bay and into the file room. I wandered up behind the counter, which Mike was attending. "Afternoon, officers," I heard Mike say. "A problem with your car?" "Are you Dennis Swift?" one of them asked. "I am not," Mike replied. "Is he here?" Mike hesitated. I could smell his sudden tension. "He may have left for the day," Mike said. "Let me check. Can I tell him who's calling?" "We have a warrant for his arrest," one of the policemen said. "I'll see if he's still in the back." Mike turned and stumbled into me. "Enzo, clear out, boy." He looked up at the police nervously. "Shop dog," he said. "Always in the way." I followed him into the back, where Denny was at the computer, logging invoices for the people who wanted their cars by the end of the day. "Den?" Mike said. "There are a couple of cops out front with a warrant." "For?" Denny asked, not even looking up from the screen, tap, tap, tapping away at his invoices. "You, for your arrest." Denny stopped what he was doing. "For what?" he asked. "I didn't get the details, but they're uniform SPD, and they don't look like male strippers, and today isn't your birthday anyway, so I don't think it's a prank." Denny stood up and started for the lobby. "I told them you might have left for the day," Mike said, indicating the back door with his chin. "I appreciate the thought, Mike, but if they've got a warrant, they probably know where I live. Let me find out what this is all about." Like a train, the three of us snaked through the file room and up to the counter. "I'm Denny Swift." The police nodded. "Could you step out from behind the counter, sir?" one of them asked. "Is there a problem? Can you tell me what this is all about?" There were half a dozen people sitting in the lobby, waiting for their invoices to be prepared. They all looked up from their reading material. "Please step out from behind the counter," the policeman said. Denny hesitated for a moment, and then followed his instructions. "We have a warrant for your arrest," one of the men said. "For what?" Denny asked. "Can I see it? There must be some mistake." The cop handed Denny a sheaf of paper. Denny read it. "You're joking," he said. "No, sir," the cop said, taking back the papers. "Please place your hands on the counter and spread your legs." Denny's boss, Craig, came out of the back. "Officers," he said, approaching them. "I don't believe this is necessary, and if it is, you can do it outside." "Sir, hold," the policeman said sternly, pointing a long finger at Craig. But Craig was right. The whole thing was designed to be prejudicial. It was the lobby of a place of business. People were there waiting for their BMWs and Mercedes Gullwings and other fancy cars. The police didn't have to do what they did in front of those people. They were customers. They trusted Denny, and now he was a criminal? What the police were doing wasn't right. There must have been a better way. But they had guns and batons. They had pepper spray and tasers. And the SPD has always been notoriously nervous. Denny followed their instructions and placed his hands on the counter and spread his legs. The cop patted him down thoroughly.
"Please turn around and place your hands behind your back," the cop said. "You don't need handcuffs," Craig said angrily. "He's not running anywhere."
"Sir,"
the cop barked.
"Hold!"
Denny turned around and placed his hands behind his back. The officer cuffed him.
"You have the right to remain silent," the cop said. "Anything you say can and will be held against you."
"How long is this going to take?" Denny asked. "I have to pick up my daughter."
"I suggest you make other arrangements," the other police officer said.
"I can pick her up, Denny,"
Mike said.
"You're not on the list of approved pickup people."
"So, who should I call?"
"An attorney will be appointed to you."
"Call Mark Fine," Denny said, desperate. "He's in the computer.
Do you understand these rights as I have read them to you?"
"Do you need me to bail you out?" Craig asked.
"Whatever you need."
"I have no idea what I need," Denny said. "Call Mark. Maybe he can pick up Zoe."
"Do you understand the rights as I have read them?"
"I understand,"
Denny snapped.
"Yes, I understand."
"What are you being arrested for?"
Mike asked. Denny looked to the officers, but they said nothing. They waited for Denny to answer the question. They were well trained in the sophisticated methods of breaking down a subject. Make him voice his own crime.
"Rape of a child in the third degree," Denny said.
"Felony rape," one of the cops clarified.
"But I didn't rape anyone," Denny said to the cop. "Who's behind this? What child?"
There was a long pause. The people in the lobby were rapt.
Denny was standing before them all, his hands bound behind his back. They could all see how he was a prisoner now. He had no use of his hands now. He could not race a car now. All attention was on the police and their blue-gray shirts with the epaulets and their black guns, sticks, wands, and leather packets wrapped around their waists. It was true drama. Everyone wanted to know the answer to the question. What child?
"The one you raped,"
the cop replied simply. I despised him for what he was doing, but I had to admire his dramatic flair. Without another word, the police took Denny away.
33.
Much of what happened to Denny regarding the custody suit concerning Zoe, as well as the criminal charges of rape of a child in the third degree, was not witnessed by me. These events spanned close to 3 years of our lives. As one of the tactics of Maxwell and Trish was to drag out the process in order to deplete Denny of money and destroy his will, as well as to play off of his desire to see Zoe mature in a loving and supportive environment. I was denied access to much information. I was not invited to attend any of the legal proceedings, for instance. I was allowed to attend only a few of the meetings Denny had with his attorney, Mark Fine, specifically those that occurred at Victrola Coffee, because Mark Fine had a fancy for the barista with the pierced eyebrow and the dark chocolate eyes. I did not accompany Denny to the police station after his arrest. I was not present for his booking, his arraignment, or his subsequent lie detector testing. Much of what I will tell you about the ordeal that followed Eve's death is a reconstruction based on information compiled by me from secondhand knowledge, overheard conversations, and established legal practices as I have gleaned from various television shows, most especially the Law and Order series and its spin-offs, Special Victims Unit, Criminal Intent, and the much maligned Trial by Jury. Further details regarding police methodology and terminology are based on two of the very best television shows in the history of the genre. The Rockford Files, starring James Garner, who also starred in the excellent racing film Grand Prix, and, of course, the greatest of all police dramas, Columbo, starring the fabulous and exceptionally clever Peter Falk in the title role. My sixth favorite actor is Peter Falk. And finally, my knowledge of the courtroom is based solely on the work of the greatest of all courtroom dramatists, Sidney Lumet, whose many films, including The Verdict and 12 Angry Men, have influenced me tremendously. And, as a side note, I would say that his casting of Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon was nothing short of inspired. My intent here is to tell our story in a dramatically truthful way. While the facts may be less than accurate, please understand that the emotion is true. The intent
is true. And, dramatically speaking, intention is everything. 34. They took him to a small room with a large table and many chairs. The walls were perforated with windows that looked out to the surrounding office, which was filled with police detectives doing their police work at their desks, just like on Law and Order. Wooden blinds filtered the blue light that crept into the room, rippling the table and floor with long shadows. No one bothered him. A bad cop didn't pull his ears or hit him with a telephone directory or smash his fingers in the door or smack his head against the chalkboard, as often happens on television. No. After being booked and fingerprinted and photographed, he was put in the room, alone, and left there, as if the police had forgotten him entirely. He sat by himself. He sat for hours with nothing. No coffee, no water, no restrooms, no radio, no distractions. His crime and his punishment and himself. Alone. Did he despair? Did he silently berate himself for allowing himself to be in that situation? Or did he finally realize what it is like to be me? To be a dog? Did he understand, as those interminable minutes ticked by, that being alone is not the same as being lonely? That being alone is a neutral state. It is like a blind fish at the bottom of the ocean, without eyes and therefore without judgment. Is it possible? That which is around me does not affect my mood. My mood affects that which is around me. Is it true? Could Denny have possibly appreciated the subjective nature of loneliness, which is something that exists only in the mind, not in the world, and, like a virus, is unable to survive without a willing host? I like to think that he was alone for that time, but that he wasn't lonely. I like to think that he thought about his condition, but he did not despair. And then Mark Fine burst into the East Precinct on Seattle's Capitol Hill. He burst in and began shouting. That is Mark Fine's blustery style. Bombastic. Boisterous. Bold. Bellicose. Mark Fine is a capital letter B. He is shaped like the letter. He acts like the letter. Brash. Brazen. Bullish. Bellowing. He blew down the door, bull-rushed the desk, blasted the sergeant on duty, and bailed out Denny. "What the fuck is this all about, Dennis?" Mark demanded on the street corner. "It's nothing," Denny said, uninterested in the conversation. "The fuck it is! A 15-year-old Dennis? The fuck it's nothing!" "She's lying." "Is she? Did you have intercourse with this girl?" "No." "Did you penetrate any of her orifices with your genitals or any other object?" Denny stared at Mark Fine and refused to answer. "This is part of a plan. Do you see that?" Mark said, frustrated. "I couldn't figure out why they would file a bogus custody suit, but this changes everything." Still, Denny said nothing. "A pedophile. A sex offender. A statutory rapist. A child molester. Do those terms fit anywhere in the concept of the best interest of a child?" Denny ground his teeth. His jaw muscles bulged. "My office. 8:30 tomorrow morning," Mark said. "Don't be late." Denny burned. "Where's Zoe?" he demanded. Mark Fine dug his heel into the pavement. "They got to her before I could," he said. "The timing on this was not an accident." "I'm going to get her," Denny said. "Don't," Mark snapped. "Let them be. Now is not the time for heroics. When you're stuck in quicksand, the worst thing you can do is struggle."
"So now I'm stuck in quicksand?" Denny asked.
"Dennis, you are in the quickest of all possible sand right now." Denny wheeled around and started off.
"And don't leave the state," Mark called after him. "And Jesus Christ, Dennis, don't even look at another 15-year-old girl."
But Denny had already rounded the corner and was gone. 35. Hands are the windows to a man's soul. Watch in-car videos of race drivers enough, and you'll see the truth of this statement. The rigid, tense grip of one driver reflects his rigid, tense driving style. The nervous hand shuffle of another driver proves how uncomfortable he is in the car. A driver's hands should be relaxed, sensitive, aware. Much information is communicated through the steering wheel of a car. Too tight or too nervous a grip will not allow the information to be communicated to the brain.
They say that senses do not operate alone, but rather are combined together in a special part of the brain that creates a picture of the body as a whole. Sensors in the skin tell the brain about pressure, pain, heat. Sensors in the joints and tendons tell the brain about the body's position in space. Sensors in the ears track balance, and sensors in internal organs indicate one's emotional state. To voluntarily restrict one channel of information is foolish for a racer. To allow information to flow unfettered is divine. Seeing Denny's hands shake was as upsetting for me as it was for him. After Eve's death, he glanced at his hands often, held them before his eyes as if they weren't really his hands at all, held them up, and watched them shake. He tried to do it so no one would see. "Nerves," he would say to me whenever he caught me watching his manual examination. "Stress." And then he would tuck them into his pants pockets and keep them there, out of sight. When Mike and Tony brought me home later that night, Denny was waiting on the dark porch with his hands in his pockets. "Not only do I not want to talk about it," he said to them, "Mark told me not to. So..." They stood on the walk, looking up at him. "Can we come in?" Mike asked. "No," Denny replied, and then, aware of his abruptness, attempted to explain. "I don't feel like company right now." They stared at him for a moment. "You don't have to talk about what's going on," Mike said. "But it's good to talk. You can't keep everything inside. It's not healthy." "You're probably right," Denny said. "But it's not how I operate. I just need to assimilate what's going on, and then I won't be able to talk. But not now." Neither Mike nor Tony moved. It was like they were deciding if they would respect Denny's request to be left alone, or if they would storm past him into the house and keep him company by force. They looked at each other, and I could smell their anxiety. I wished that Denny would understand the depth of their concern for him. "You'll be all right?" Mike asked. "We don't have to worry about the gas oven being left on and you lighting a cigarette or something." "It's electric," Denny said, "and I don't smoke." "You'll be all right," Tony said to Mike. "You want us to keep Enzo or something?" Mike asked. "No." "Bring you some groceries?" Denny shook his head. "You'll be all right," Tony said again and tugged at Mike's arm. "My phone's always on," Mike said. 24-hour crisis hotline. Need to talk, need anything, call me." They retreated down the walk. "We fed Enzo," Mike called from the alley. They left, and Denny and I went inside. He took his hands from his pockets and held them up to look at them shaking. "Rapists don't get custody of their little girls," he said. "See how that works?" I followed him into the kitchen, for a moment concerned that he had lied to Mike and Tony, and that perhaps we did have a gas oven after all. But he didn't go to the oven. He went to the cupboard and took out a glass. Then he reached into where he kept the liquor and took out a bottle. He poured a drink. It was absurd. Depressed, stressed, hands shaking, and now he was going to get himself drunk? I couldn't stand for it. I barked sharply at him. He looked down at me, drink in hand, and I up at him. If I'd had hands, I would have opened one of them and slapped him with it. "What's the matter, Enzo? Too much of a cliché for you?" I barked again. Too much of a pathetic cliché for me. "Don't judge me," he said. "That's not your job. Your job is to support me, not judge me." He drank the drink and then glared at me. And I did judge him. He was acting just as they wanted him to act. They were rattling him, and he was about to quit, and then it would be over, and I'd have to spend the rest of my life with a drunkard who had nothing to do but stare lifelessly out from his dead eyes at pictures flashing by on the TV screen. This wasn't my Denny. This was a pathetic character from a hackneyed television drama, and I didn't like him at all. I left the room thinking I would go to bed, but I didn't want to sleep in the same room as this Denny imposter, this Denny facsimile. I went into Zoe's bedroom, curled up on the floor next to her bed, and tried to sleep. Zoe was the only one I had left. Later, though I don't know how much, he stood in the doorway. "The first time I took you for a drive in my car when you were a puppy, you puked all over the seat," he said to me. "But I didn't give up on you." I lifted my head from the ground, not understanding his point. "I put the booze away," he said. "I'm better than that." He turned and walked away. I heard him shuffle around in the living room and then turn on the TV. So he didn't fall hopelessly into the bottle, the refuge of the weak and the maudlin. He got my point. Gestures are all that I have. I found him on the couch watching a video of Eve, Zoe, and me from years ago when we went to Long Beach on the Washington coast. Zoe was a toddler. I remembered that weekend well. We were all so young, it seemed, chasing kites on the wide beach that went on for miles. I sat next to the couch and watched, too. We were so naive. We had no knowledge of where the road would take us, no idea that we would ever be separated. The beach, the ocean, the sky, it was there for us and only for us. A world without end. No race has ever been won in the first corner, he said. But plenty of races have been lost there. I looked at him. He reached out, settled his hand on the crown of my head, and scratched my ear like he has always done. That's right, he said to me. If we're going to be a cliché, let's be a positive cliché. Yes, the race is long. To finish first, first you must finish. 36. I love very few things more than a nice long walk in the drizzle of Seattle. I don't care for the heaviness of real rain. I like the misting, the feeling of the tiny droplets on my muzzle and eyelashes, the freshness of the air, which has been suddenly infused with ozone and negative ions. While rain is heavy and can suppress the scents, a light shower actually amplifies smells. It releases the molecules, brings odor to life, and then carries it through the air to my nose. Which is why I love Seattle more than any other place, even Thunderhill Raceway Park. Because while the summers are very dry, once the damp season begins, nary a day goes by without a helping of my much-loved drizzle. Denny took me for a walk in the drizzle, and I relished it. Eve had only been dead for a few days, but since her death I had felt so bottled up and congested, sitting with Denny in the house for much of the time, breathing the same stale air over and over. Denny seemed to crave the change, too. Instead of jeans, a sweatshirt, and his yellow slicker, he put on a pair of dark slacks, and he wore his black trench coat over a high-necked cashmere sweater. We walked north, out of Madison Valley, and into the Arboretum. Once we passed the dangerous part, where there is no walkway and the cars drive well over the safe speed limit, we turned off on the smaller road, and Denny released me from my leash. This is what I love to do. I love to run through a field of wet grass that has not been mowed recently. I love to run, keeping my snout low to the ground so the grass and the sparkles of water cover my face. I imagine myself as a vacuum cleaner, sucking in all the smells, all the life, a spear of summer grass. It reminds me of my childhood, back on the farm in Spangle, where there was no rain, but there was grass. There were fields, and I ran. I ran and I ran that day. And Denny walked on, trudging steadily. At the point where we usually turned around, we kept going. We crossed the pedestrian bridge and curled up into Montlake. Denny reattached my leash, and we crossed a larger road, and we were in a new park. I loved this one, too, but it was different. Interlaken, Denny said to me as he unleashed me. Interlaken. This park was not fields and flatland. It was a gnarled and twisty ravine painted with vines and bushes and ground cover, tented by the tallest of trees and a canopy of leaves. It was wonderful. As Denny followed the path, I bounded up and down the hillside, hiding in the low brush and pretending I was a secret agent, or running as fast as I could through the obstacles and pretending I was a predator like in the movies, hunting something down, tracking my prey. For a long time we walked and ran in this park, me running five paces for every one of Denny's until I was exhausted and thirsty. We emerged from the park and walked in a neighborhood that was foreign to me. Denny stopped in a cafe to purchase a cup of coffee for himself. He brought some water for me, which was in a paper cup and difficult to drink, but sated me nonetheless. And we continued walking. I have always loved activity and walking, especially with Denny, my favorite walking partner, and especially in the drizzle. But I have to admit, at that time, I was getting quite tired. We had been out for more than 2 hours, and after a long walk like that, I like to go home for a playful toweling off and then settle down for a nice long nap. But there was no nap. We kept walking. I recognized 15th Avenue when we reached it, and I knew Volunteer Park quite well. but I was surprised when we went into the Lakeview Cemetery. Of course, I knew the importance of Lakeview Cemetery, though I had never been there. I had seen a documentary on Bruce Lee. Lakeview is where he is buried, alongside his son, Brandon, who was a wonderful actor until his untimely death. I feel very badly for Brandon Lee, because he fell victim to the family curse, but also because the last film he made was The Crow, an unfortunate title for an unfortunate film based on a comic book written by someone who clearly had no idea of the real nature of crows. But that's a discussion for another time. We entered the cemetery, and we did not seek out the graves of Bruce and Brandon Lee, two very fine actors. We sought something else. Following the paved road to the north, we looped around the central hill and came upon a temporary tent structure, under which many people were assembled. They were all dressed nicely, and those who weren't protected from the drizzle by the tent were holding umbrellas. Immediately, I saw Zoe. Ah, the light switch. It's either on or it's off. Denny had dressed for the event. We approached the people, who were slightly disorganized, milling about, their collective attention fragmented. The proceedings had not yet begun. We got very close to them, and then, suddenly, someone broke off from the group. A man. And then another man, and another. The three of them walked toward us. One of them was Maxwell. The others were Eve's brothers, whose names I never knew because they showed themselves so infrequently. "You're not welcome here," Maxwell said sternly. "She's my wife," Denny said calmly, "the mother of my child." She was there, the child. Zoe saw her father. She waved at him, and he waved back. "You're not welcome here," Maxwell said again. "Leave or I'll call the police." The two brothers raised themselves, pre-battle posturing. "You already called them, didn't you?" Denny asked. Maxwell sneered at Denny. "You were warned," he said. "Why are you doing this?" Maxwell pushed up into Denny's personal space. "You've never been good to Eve," Maxwell said. "And with what you did to Annika, I will not trust you with Zoe." Nothing happened that night, but Maxwell had already turned. "Please escort Mr. Swift away from here," he said to his two sons, and he abruptly walked away. In the distance, I saw Zoe, unable to contain herself any longer. She jumped out of her seat and ran toward us. "Beat it," one of the men said. "It's my wife's funeral," Denny said. "I'm staying." "Get the hell out of here," the other man said, jabbing Denny in the ribs. "Punch me if you want," Denny said. "I won't fight back." "Child molester," the first man hissed, flinging his hands into Denny's chest. Denny didn't budge. A man who drives a 2,000-pound car at 170 miles per hour does not get flustered by the honking of the geese. Zoe reached us and leapt at Denny. He hoisted her into the air and propped her on his hip and kissed her cheek. "How's my baby?" he asked. "How's my daddy?" she replied. "I'm getting by," he said. He turned to the brother who had just pushed him. "Sorry, I didn't catch what you just said. Maybe you'd like to repeat it in front of my daughter." The man took a step back, and then Trish rushed up to us. She inserted herself between Denny and the brothers. She told them to leave, and she turned to Denny. "Please," she said. "I understand why you're here, but it can't be done like this. I really don't think you should stay." She hesitated for a moment, and then she said, "I'm sorry. You must be so alone." Denny didn't respond. I looked up at him, and his eyes were full of tears. Zoe noticed, too, and started crying with him. "It's okay to cry," she said. "Grandma says crying helps because it washes away the hurting." He looked at Zoe for a long moment, and she at him. Then he sighed sadly. "You help Grandma and Grandpa be strong, okay?" he said. "I have some important business to take care of. About Mommy. There are things that have to be done." "I know," she said. "You'll stay with Grandma and Grandpa for a little bit longer, until I get everything worked out, okay?" "They told me I might stay with them for a while." "Well," he said regretfully, "Grandma and Grandpa are very good at thinking ahead." "We can all compromise," Trish said. "I know you're not a bad person."
"There is no compromise," Denny said.
"Given time, you'll see. It's what's best for Zoe."
"Enzo!"
Zoe called out suddenly, locating me beneath her. She squirmed loose of Denny and grabbed me around the neck.
"Enzo!"
I was surprised and pleased by her hearty greeting, so I licked her face. Trish leaned in to Denny.
"You must have been missing Eve terribly," she whispered to him. "But to take advantage of a 15-year-old girl."
Denny abruptly straightened and pulled away from her. "Zoe," he said, "Enzo and I are going to watch from a special spot. Come on, Enzo." He bent down and kissed her forehead, and we walked away. Zoe and Trish watched us go. We continued on the circular path and walked up the bump of a hill to the top, where we stood underneath the trees, and protected from the lightly falling rain, watched the whole thing. The people coming to attention, the man reading from a book, the people laying roses on the coffin, and everyone leaving in their cars. We stayed. We waited for the workers who came and dismantled the tents, the workers who came and used a strange winch device to lower the coffin into the ground. We stayed. We watched the men with their little caterpillar as they shoveled all the dirt over her. We waited. When they were all gone, we walked down the hill, and we stood before the mound of dirt, and we cried. We kneeled, and we cried, and we grabbed at handfuls of the dirt, the mound, and we felt the last bit of her, the last part of her that we could feel, and we cried. And finally, when we could do no more, we stood, and we began the long walk home. 37. The morning after Eve's funeral, I could barely move. My body was so stiff, I couldn't even stand, and Denny had to look for me, because I usually got up immediately and helped him with breakfast. I was 8 years old, 2 years older than Zoe, though I felt much more like her uncle than her brother. While I was still too young to suffer an arthritic condition in my hips, that's exactly what I suffered from. Degenerative arthritis caused by hip dysplasia. It was an unpleasant condition, yes, but in a sense, it was a relief that I could concentrate on my own difficulties rather than dwell on other things that preoccupied my thoughts, specifically Zoe being stranded with the twins. I was quite young when I understood that my hips were abnormal. I had spent most of my first months of life running and playing with Denny, just the two of us, and so I had little opportunity to compare myself with other dogs. When I was old enough to frequent dog parks, I realized that keeping my hind legs together in my gait, though much more comfortable for me, was an obvious sign that my hips were defective. The last thing I wanted was to be seen as a misfit, so I trained myself to walk and run in certain ways to disguise my defect. As I matured and the protective cartilage at the ends of my bones wore away, as cartilage tends to do, the pain became more acute. And yet, instead of complaining, I tried to hide my problem. Perhaps I have always been more like Eve than I've ever admitted, for I distrusted the medical world immensely, and I found ways to compensate for my disability so I could avoid a diagnosis that would undoubtedly hasten my demise. As I mentioned, I do not know the source of Eve's distrust of medicine. The origins of my distrust, however, are all too clear. When I was just a pup, not more than a week or two old, the alpha man on the farm in Spangle introduced me to a friend of his. The man held me in his lap and petted me, feeling my forelegs at length.
"They should come off," he said to the alpha man.
"I'll hold him," the alpha man said.
"He needs anesthetic, Will. You should have called me last week."
"I'm not wasting my money on a dog, Doc," the alpha man said. "Cut."
I had no idea what they were talking about, but then the alpha man gripped me tightly around my midsection. The other man, Doc, took hold of my right paw and, with shiny scissors that glinted in the sunlight, snipped off my right dew claw. My right thumb. The pain blazed through my body, a racking, shattering pain. It was bloody and horrible, and I cried out. I struggled mightily to free myself, but the alpha man squeezed me so tightly I could barely breathe. Then Doc took hold of my left paw and, without hesitating for a moment, cut off my left thumb. Click. I remember that, perhaps more than the pain, the sound. Click. So loud. And then the blood was everywhere. The pain was so intense it left me shivering and weak. Later, Doc applied salve to my wounds and wrapped my forelegs tightly and whispered to me, "It's a mean bastard who won't pay for a little local anesthetic for his pups. Do you see? This is why I distrust them. It's a mean bastard who will do the cutting without anesthetic because he wants to get paid." The day after Eve's funeral, Denny took me to the vet, a thin man who smelled of hay and who had a bottomless pocket full of treats. He felt my hips, and I tried not to wince, but I couldn't help myself when he squeezed certain places. He diagnosed me, prescribed anti-inflammatory medication, and said there was nothing else he could do except, someday in the future, perform expensive surgery to replace my defective parts. Denny thanked the man and drove me home. "You have hip dysplasia," he said to me. If I'd had fingers, I'd have shoved them into my ears until I burst my own eardrums. Anything to avoid hearing. "Hip dysplasia," he repeated, shaking his head in amazement. I shook my head, too. With my diagnosis, I knew, would come my end. Slowly, perhaps, painfully, without a doubt, marked by the signposts laid out by the veterinarian, the visible becomes inevitable. The car goes where the eyes go. Whatever the trauma that led to Eve's distrust of medicine, I was able to see only the effects. She had been unable to look away from where the others had told her to look. It is a rare person who can hear the blunt authority of a terminal diagnosis, refuse to accept it, and choose a different path. I thought of Eve and how quickly she embraced her death once the people around her agreed to it. I considered the foretelling of my own end, which was to be full of suffering and pain, as death is believed to be by most of the world, and I tried to look away. Because of the criminal charges against Denny, the twins had been granted a temporary restraining order that meant, pending challenge in court, Denny didn't get to see Zoe at all for several months. Minutes after he was arrested, Maxwell and Trish filed a motion to terminate Denny's right to custody of any kind, since he was clearly an unfit parent, a pedophile, a sex offender. Well, we all play by the same rules. It's just that some people spend more time reading those rules and figuring out how to make them work in their behalf. I have seen movies that involve abducted children and the grief and terror that suffocate the parents when their children are taken by strangers. Denny felt every bit of that grief, and, in my own way, I did too. And we knew where Zoe was. We knew who had taken her. And still, we could do nothing. Mark Fine suggested it would be inflammatory to tell Zoe about the legal proceedings. And he suggested that Denny invent a story about driving race cars in Europe to explain his prolonged absence. Mark Fine also negotiated a letter exchange. Notes and drawings made by Zoe would be delivered to Denny, and Denny could write letters to his child, as long as he agreed to allow those letters to be censored by the twins' counsel. I will tell you, every vertical surface in our house was decorated with Zoe's delightful artwork, and many long nights were spent by Denny and me crafting the letters we sent to Zoe, telling of Denny's exploits on the European race circuit. As much as I wanted Denny to act, to lash out against the establishment in a bold and passionate way, I respected his restraint. Denny has long admired the great driver Emerson Fittipaldi. Emo, as he was called by his peers, was a champion of great stature and consistency, and was known for his pragmatism on the track. Taking chances is not a good idea, if choosing wrong may send you into the wall at Indy, twist your car into a fiery metal sculpture that emergency workers struggle to untangle while your flesh is melted from your bones by the invisible flames of burning ethanol. Not only did Emo never panic, Emo never put himself in a position where he might have to. Like Emo, Denny never took unnecessary risks. While I, too, admire and try to emulate Emo, I still think that I would like to drive like Ayrton Senna, full of emotion and daring. I would like to have packed our necessities in the BMW, driven by Zoe's school one day to pick her up unannounced, and then headed directly for Canada. From Vancouver, we could have driven east to Montreal, where they have many fabulous road courses, and where they host a Formula One Grand Prix every summer, to live by ourselves in peace for the rest of our lives. But it was not my choice. I was not behind the wheel. No one cared a whit about me. Which is why they were all in such a state of panic when Zoe asked her grandparents if she could see me. You see, no one had accounted for my whereabouts. The twins, not knowing where their elaborate fiction had placed me, immediately called Mark Fine, who immediately called Denny to outline the nature of our predicament.
"She believes it all!"
I could hear Mark shout over the phone, even though the phone was pressed to Denny's ear.
"So where did you leave the fucking dog? You could have taken him with you, but there are quarantine rules. Does she know about quarantine?"
"Tell her of course she can see Enzo," Denny said calmly. "Enzo is staying with Mike and Tony while I'm in Europe. Zoe likes them, and she'll believe it. I'll have Mike bring Enzo over on Saturday." And that's what happened. In the early afternoon, Mike picked me up and drove me over to Mercer Island, and I spent the afternoon playing with Zoe on the Great Lawn. Before dinner time, Mike returned me to Denny.
"How did she look?"
Denny asked Mike.
"She looked terrific," Mike said. "She has her mother's smile."
"They had a good time together?"
"A fantastic time. They played all day."
"Fetch?" Denny asked, thirsty for details.
"Did she use the chuck it, or did they play chase? Eve never liked it when they played chase."
"No, mostly fetch," Mike said kindly.
"I never minded when they played chase because I know Enzo, but Eve was always..."
"You know," Mike said, "sometimes they just flopped down on the grass and cuddled together. It was really sweet."
Denny wiped his nose quickly.
"Thanks, Mike," he said.
"Really.
Thanks a lot."
"Anytime," Mike said.
I appreciated Mike's effort to appease Denny, even though he was avoiding the truth. Or maybe Mike didn't see what I saw. Maybe he couldn't hear what I heard. Zoe's profound sadness, her loneliness, her whispered plans that she and I would somehow smuggle ourselves off to Europe and find her father. That summer without Zoe was very painful for Denny. In addition to feeling isolated from his daughter, his career was derailed. Though he was offered the opportunity to drive again for the racing team he was with the previous year, he was forced to decline, as the pending criminal case demanded that he remain in the state of Washington at all times, or he would forfeit his bond. Further, he was not allowed to accept any of the lucrative teaching jobs and commercial work offers that came his way. After his spectacular experience at Thunderhill, he was highly recommended in the commercial industry and received offers over the phone fairly frequently. These jobs almost always took place in California, or sometimes in Nevada or Texas, and occasionally in Connecticut, and therefore were forbidden to him. He was a prisoner of the state. And yet, we are all afforded our physical existence so we can learn about ourselves. So I understand why Denny, on a deeper level, allowed this situation to befall him. I won't say he created the situation, but he allowed it, because he needed to test his mettle. He wanted to know how long he could keep his foot on the accelerator before lifting. He chose this life, and therefore he chose this battle. And I realized, as the summer matured and I frequently visited Zoe without Denny, that I was part of this too. I was integral to the drama. Because on those late Saturday afternoons in July, after Mike reviewed the events of the day with Denny and then returned to his own world, Denny would sit with me on the back porch and quiz me.
"Did you play fetch? Did you tug? Did you chase?"
he would ask.
"Did you cuddle?"
he would ask.
"How did she look? Is she eating enough fruit? Are they buying organic?"
I tried. I tried as hard as I could to form words for him, but they wouldn't come. I tried to beam my thoughts into his head via telepathy. I tried to send him the pictures I saw in my mind. I twitched my ears, I cocked my head, I nodded, I pawed, until he smiled at me and stood.
"Thanks, Enzo," he would say on those days. "You're not too tired, are you?"
I would stand and wag. I'm never too tired.
"Let's go, then."
He would grab the chucket and the tennis ball and walk me down to the Blue Dog Park, and we would play fetch until the light grew thin and the mosquitoes came out of hiding, thirsty for their dinner. 39. There was an occasion that summer when Denny found a teaching engagement in Spokane and, via Mike, our faux intercontinental liaison, asked if the twins could take me for the weekend. They agreed, as they had grown accustomed to my presence in their home, and I had always handled myself with the utmost dignity when I was around them, never soiling their expensive rugs or carpets, never begging for food, and never drooling when I slept. I would much rather have gone to racing school with Denny, but I understood that he depended on me to take care of Zoe, and also to act as some kind of a witness on his behalf. Though I could not relate to him the details of our visits, My presence, I think, reassured him in some way. On a Friday afternoon, I was delivered by Mike into Zoe's waiting embrace. She immediately ushered me into her room, and we played a game of dress-up together. To say that I was taking one for the team would be an understatement, considering the crazy outfits I was forced to wear. But that's my ego speaking. I knew my role as jester in Zoe's court, and I was happy to play the part. That evening, Maxwell took me outside earlier than usual, urging me to get busy. When I came back inside, I was led to Zoe's room, which already had my bed in it. Apparently she had requested I sleep with her rather than by the back door, or, God forbid, in the garage. I curled into a ball and quickly dozed off. A bit later, I woke. The lights were dim. Zoe was awake and active, encircling my bed with piles of her stuffed animals.
"They'll keep you company,"
she whispered to me as she surrounded me, seemingly hundreds of them, all shapes and sizes. I was being surrounded by teddy bears and giraffes, sharks and dogs, cats and birds and snakes. She worked steadily, and I watched, until I was nothing more than a small atoll on the Pacific, and the animals were my coral reef. I found it somewhat amusing and touching that Zoe cared to share me with her animals in that way, and I drifted off to sleep, feeling protected and safe. I awoke later in the night and saw that the wall of animals around me was quite high. Still, I was able to shift my weight and change position to make myself more comfortable. But when I did, I was shocked by a frightening sight. One of the animals, the one on top, staring straight at me. It was the zebra. The replacement zebra. The one she had chosen to fill in for the demon that had dismantled itself before me so long ago, the horrifying zebra of my past. The demon had returned, and though it was dark in the room, I know I saw a glint of light in its eyes. As you can imagine, my sleep that night was sparse. The last thing I wanted was to awaken amid animal carnage because the demon had returned. I forced myself to stay awake, yet I couldn't help but drift off. Each time I opened my eyes, I found the zebra staring at me. Like a gargoyle, it stood on a cathedral of animals above me, watching. The other animals had no life. They were toys. The zebra alone knew. I felt sluggish all day, but I did my best to keep up, and I tried to catch up on my sleep by napping quietly. To any observer, I'm sure I gave off the impression of being quite contented. However, I was anxious about nightfall, concerned that, once again, the zebra would torture me with its mocking eyes. That afternoon, as the twins took their alcohol on the deck, as they tended to do, and Zoe watched television in the TV room, I dozed outside in the sun, and I heard them.
"I know it's for the best," Trish said, "but still, I feel badly for him."
"It's for the best," Maxwell said.
"I know, but still..."
"He forced himself on a teenage girl," Maxwell said sternly. "What kind of a father preys on innocent young girls?"
I lifted my head from the warm wood of the deck and saw Trish cluck and shake her head.
"What?" Maxwell demanded.
"From what I hear, she's not that innocent."
"What you hear?" Maxwell blurted. "He forced himself on a young girl. That's rape."
"I know, I know. It's just that the timing of her coming forward is a big coincidence."
"Are you suggesting that she made it up?"
"No," Trish said. "But why did Pete wait to tell us about it until after you complained to him so bitterly that you were certain we wouldn't get custody of Zoe?"
"I don't care about any of that," Maxwell said, waving her off. "He wasn't good enough for Eve, and he's not good enough for Zoe. And if he's stupid enough to get caught with his pants down and his pecker in his fist, you're going to be damn sure I'm going to seize the moment. Zoe will have a better childhood with us. She will have a better moral raising, a better financial raising, a better family life, and you know it, Trish. You know it."
"I know. I know,"
she said, and sipped her amber drink with the bright red cherry drowned at the bottom of the glass. "But he's not a bad person." He poured his drink down his gullet and slapped the glass down on the teak table.
"It's time to start dinner," he said, and he went inside.
I was stunned. I, too, had noted the coincidence of events, and I had been suspicious since the beginning. But to hear the words, the coldness in Maxwell's tone. Imagine this.
Imagine having your wife die suddenly of brain cancer. Then imagine having her parents attack you mercilessly in order to gain custody of your daughter. Imagine that they exploit allegations of sexual molestation against you. They hire very expensive and clever lawyers because they have much more money than you have. Imagine that they prevent you from having any contact with your 6-year-old daughter for months on end. And imagine they restrict your ability to earn money to support yourself and, of course, as you hope, your daughter. How long would you last before your will was broken? They had no idea who they were dealing with. Denny would not kneel before them. He would never quit. He would never break. With disgust, I followed them into the house. Trish began her preparations, and Maxwell took his jar of peppers from the refrigerator. Inside me, a darkness brewed. Contrivers. Manipulators. They were no longer people to me. They were now the evil twins. Evil, horrible, dastardly people who stuffed themselves with burning hot peppers in order to fuel the bile in their stomachs. When they laughed, flames shot out of their noses. They were not worthy of life, these people. They were disgusting creatures, nitrogen-based life forms that lived in the very darkest corners of the very deepest lakes, where there is no light, and the pressure crushes everything to sand. Deep, dark places where oxygen would never dare venture. My anger with the evil twins fed my thirst for revenge, and I was not above using the tools of my dogness to exact justice. I presented myself to Maxwell as he stuffed another pepper into his mouth and pulverized it with the ceramic teeth he removed at night. I sat before him. I lifted a paw.
"Want a treat?"
he asked me, clearly surprised by my gesture. I barked.
"Here you go, boy."
He extracted a pepper from the bottle and held it before my nose. It was a very large one, long and artificially green, and smelling of sulfites and nitrates. The devil's candy.
"I don't think those are good for dogs," Trish said.
"He likes them,"
Maxwell countered. My first thought was to take the pepperoncini and a couple of Maxwell's fingers with it. But that would have caused real problems, and I likely would have been euthanized before Mike could return to save me, so I didn't take his fingers. I did, however, take the pepper. I knew it was bad for me, that I would suffer immediate discomfort. But I knew my discomfort would pass, and I anticipated the unpleasant rebound effect, which is what I wanted. After all, I am just a stupid dog, unworthy of human scorn, without the brains to be responsible for my own bodily functions. A dumb dog. I observed their dinner carefully because I wanted to see for myself. The twins served Zoe some kind of chicken covered in a creamy sauce. They didn't know that while Zoe loved chicken cutlets, she never ate them with sauce, and certainly never with cream. She disliked the consistency. When she didn't eat the string beans they served, Trish asked if she would like a banana instead. Zoe replied affirmatively, and Trish made some banana slices, which Zoe barely picked at because they were crudely sliced and speckled with brown spots, which she always avoided. When Denny prepared her bananas for her, he took great care in slicing them in uniform thickness after removing any and all brown spots he could find. And these agents of evil, these supposed grandparents, thought Zoe would be better off with them. Bah! They didn't spend a moment thinking about her welfare. After dinner, they didn't even ask why she hadn't eaten the bananas. They allowed her to leave the table, having eaten almost nothing. Denny never would have allowed that. He would have prepared for her something she liked, and he would have required that she eat a sufficient dinner to continue to grow in a healthy way. All the while I watched, I seethed, and in my stomach, a foul concoction steeped. When it was time to take me out that night, Maxwell opened the French door to the back deck and began his idiotic chanting,
"Get busy, boy! Get busy!"
I didn't go outside. I looked up at him, and I thought about what he was doing, how he was rending our family, pulling apart the fabric of our lives for his own smug, self-congratulatory purposes. I thought about how he and Trish were grossly inferior guardians for my Zoe. I crouched in my stance right there, inside the house, and I shat a massive, soupy, pungent pile of diarrhea on his beautiful, expensive, linen-colored Berber carpet.
"What the hell?" he shouted at me. "Bad dog!"
I turned and trotted cheerfully to Zoe's room.
Get busy, motherfucker, I said as I left. But, of course, he couldn't hear me. As I settled into my lagoon of stuffed animals, I heard Maxwell exclaim loudly and call for Trish to clean up my mess.